Blog Talk Radio.
And baseball fans everywhere. My name is Michael Lacolin, and on behalf of my partners, I welcome you back to another episode of the Metsian Podcast. The season opener is just 3 days and a wake-up away, and so let's go Mets. First, let me thank Mr. Adam Spiegel for our opening tune and sort of sets the vibe for us. But we have a lot to discuss, and by we, I mean you, the listener, my partners, and this evening's esteemed guests. When I say that we have the tri-state area covered, I tell you no lie. I'm speaking to you from Brooklyn. Our president of podcast operations usually hails from Manhattan. Hello, Sam Maxwell, and where in the world is your phone pinging from this evening?
Well, I mean, I don't think I've done this internationally yet, so I usually am somewhere in the tri-state one way or another, and today I am in Leeds, New York, upstate, beautiful upstate, about 2 hours up the thruway. So everybody, give upstate as many chances as you can this spring and summer. There's plenty to see.
Hear, hear for upstate, and are forming our Metsian triumvirate. Our comrade from Connecticut, Rich Farrago. Hello, my friend.
Hello, Michael. Very, very exciting evening here as we get ready to commence Mets baseball. And it wouldn't be Mets baseball if there wasn't a lot of stuff to talk about. And I'm looking forward to getting into the stuff.
It just seems to come with the territory, no matter who's in charge. Let us not waste any time. Our guest this evening, our co-hosts of the National League Town podcast. We're appreciative and thankful for your appearance this evening, respectively. First, let me say hello to Jeff Heisen, and welcome, sir, to the Metsian podcast.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
The pleasure is ours, sir. And secondly, your partner and a dear friend of this show, Mr. Greg Prince. Hello, sir.
Hello, Mike. Good to talk to the tri-state area and all the ships at sea.
So here we are. We are gathered here together to talk Mets baseball. The upcoming season, and, you know, just to get warmed up, let's get limbered up, let's stretch. Let's just get the initial impression of the season opener. Now, it's not the home opener, but it's the season opener nonetheless. We open up April 7th at Washington. Hopefully we spoil their opening day. So, you know, just general impressions. How do you feel this time of year? I will say that the fever has hit me in a timely manner. Sometimes it hits me later than other seasons. I still have basketball and hockey on my mind. And I will say that the excitement and joy of baseball has entered my soul in a very timely manner this season. I will just lead off with this quirky nonsense. When we do get to the home opener on April 15th, we'll be playing the Arizona Diamondbacks. And I don't know about you guys, but that strikes me as a little weird as opposed to a division opponent. And but in one way, it reminds me of 1993 when we played the Colorado Rockies. At least that was a historic day because that was their first ever game. This one, I don't know. Rich, we discussed this last week as far as scheduling and all. But I will start with our guest. And Jeff, once again, on behalf of my partners here, welcome. And your opening impressions of the 2022 season to come.
Well, this is a real home opener for me because while I grew up in Great Neck, I live in Maryland. So I have tickets for Friday. And a week ago, I was very excited about seeing Scherzer and sitting in enemy territory cheering on Max Scherzer's first appearance in a Mets uniform on a beautiful night. Well, it's a week later. Scherzer is iffy. He may not pitch at all that weekend, or he may pitch Thursday, which is the best case scenario. And it's supposed to be 50 degrees and rainy on Thursday and Friday. So my enthusiasm has been curbed somewhat.
Ugh, dress appropriately. Greg, like I said, this is just warming up, getting the muscles loose. What's your impressions of the season to come? How do you feel?
We have, as you said, a good 3.5 days or thereabouts. I was more excited before Jacob deGrom felt something in his shoulder, and more excited before Max Scherzer's hamstring reminded him he is now a New York Met. But I think by Thursday, I'll be pretty excited. I think 8 days later, when the Arizona Diamondbacks roll into town, they'll be following in the footsteps of, indeed, the 93 Rockies and the 2009 and 2013 San Diego Padres, to name some unlikely Western Division visitors to our environs. But, you know, we know that the lockout played a little bit of havoc with the schedule. Perhaps Ollie Perez will be part of the Arizona Diamondbacks, and we can take him out to the parking lot and show him where he pitched at Shea Stadium, since he's one of the last two active members of a Shea Stadium club still in the major leagues, if he makes the Diamondbacks. And more importantly, maybe we can take one of his pitches out into the parking lot or environs thereof. But you know what? It's the end of spring training, and even though spring training was compressed, it already feels like it's gone on too long. So, yes, indeed, bring on the season.
And if Arizona
feels like it. Oh, go ahead, Jeff.
No, if Arizona feels like a weird home opener, wait till next year with the never-ending interleague play, so the Mets could open the season against the Seattle Mariners. Imagine the excitement about that.
Goodness gracious. Rich, we started talking about that last week. How are you feeling?
No, my enthusiasm's really high, Mike. Of course, you know, like the anticipated weather in Washington, D.C., and thank you, Jeff, for that. I was going to ask you that because you live in the area. With the anticipated weather like that, my enthusiasm is slightly dampened by the DeGrom and Scherzer news, but I'm ready to go. I think the Mets have a solid ball club, and probably the most bolstering fact of all is that they will do what it takes to improve the team. You know, there are no more financial restraints. If they have to take on a contract, they will. If they have to be aggressive, they will. They're not in this thing to have a, you know, this is not a 2013 kind of a year where you're okay, well, you're kind of throwing the season away. We all knew that, to get better in the near future. This isn't that. They're here to win this year. And they've had a couple of injuries. Okay. But I have full confidence in Steve Cohen and in Billy Epler to do what's necessary. And I'm ready to go.
Yo, Mikey?
Did we lose
my Mike? Apologies. No, my apologies.
No.
So, Sam, dollar you know, exactly. We're all lacing up our boots, getting ready to jump down that rabbit hole. But so far in the spring, you know, how do you feel going into the season? How are those baseball sensibilities?
Well, first of all, I was hoping that the DeGrom news meant that it would be somewhat of a full circle for Max Scherzer, where he started his National League career in Nationals Park against the Mets. I'm sorry, not his National League career, but his Nationals career, because he was with the Diamondbacks full circle as well. So I find it unfortunate that it's not going to be his first time, the first game of the season, that now he's on the Mets and he's facing his old team, the Nationals, in the same place that he debuted for them. I was hoping that was the case. That's the narrative. But, of course, you know, good things can't always come in fun sizes. If he has to pitch Thursday, so be it. If that's the what, you know, the end-all be-all is with this hamstring injury, okay. But I can see how the damp weather is making it for the Mets fan. But at the same time, I'm just always excited, especially now, you know, you can't ever take baseball for granted because you might not see it till July. And that happened 2 years ago. So I'm glad, for one, they got their act together, and we're not even hardly talking about that anymore. We're actually talking about baseball again. And one way or another, whatever happens. I think that Buck, of all of these managers, is the best to weather the same old Mets storm, if you will. So I think that we're ready to see a manager who can get the most out of whatever roster he's given, and I do think that's going to be the narrative with some of these injuries going on.
We shall see. Let's dissect this DeGrom situation. We know age is no longer on his side. He has a history of injury, and this shoulder, and Sam, you and I talked about this much earlier this afternoon. We've become so knowledgeable in the range of body ailments that a pitcher can incur ever since Matt Harvey and you know, thoracic outlet syndrome to this, a scapula. Really? How we've become quite knowledgeable. We've seen a whole rigmarole of things pass through Flushing. Greg, I will start with you on this one. Only because I think there's an old school argument to be made. I'd like to bring Mr. Mike Marshall into this conversation. One-time National League pitcher and Cy Young Award winner with the Dodgers back in the 70s. In his post-playing career, a doctor, did a lot of research into micro tears, micro fractures, arm injuries, things of that nature, et cetera, et cetera. And I always thought baseball as a whole ignored his work. I have a beef with this 12-month-a-year regimen that athletes go through nowadays. There is no break. It's just, you know, pedal to the metal, modern conditioning, and they're trained to throw six innings, give it all you got. And, you know, we can use recent examples insofar as body type. Pedro Martinez comes to mind. If you want to go farther back, perhaps Ron Guidry. And I will also say, you know, a guy like Nolan Ryan, he used to throw a football in between starts. And after every start, would get back on the stationary bicycle for another 2 hours. So I don't know what's going on. Modern versus old school. But we have real concerns over Jacob DeGrom. No one's ever been able really to pinpoint exactly what this is. And now we're given this definition, this diagnosis. What say you, sir?
Well, Mike Marshall pitched in 106 games that 1 year, 90 in another year, and lasted a good 15 years in the majors. So maybe he should have been listened to while he was with us. Jacob DeGrom has done all right for himself, but, you know, we have had not a full season of Jacob DeGrom for quite a while. And, you know, it almost feels, if you remember, and Mike and Jeff and Rich are certainly in the demographic to remember this, the Little Rascals. Do you remember Alfalfa? Passed himself off as the big football hero and kept telling Darla, oh, no, they're saving me for when it's really important, because he was just sitting on the bench. It sometimes feels like that with Jacob DeGrom. It feels like he's the best you can do with him is say he's really going to be good when he's healthy again. And except, you know, he actually does pitch now and then, pitches more than now and then, and only he can know what his arm feels like, and only the Mets have a view of what his insides, so to speak, look like. Is it his conditioning? Is it the modern conditioning, as you say? I really don't know. I mean, this is the era we're living in. This is the era Jacob DeGrom is living in. And it's kind of hard to expect Jacob DeGrom to go, punch a barrel full of rice, which I think was Steve Carlton's workout regimen. And, you know, he pitched into his 40s. We have all these great anecdotal stories of Hall of Fame pitchers who didn't really miss much time and lasted a long time. You know, the thing that I think always concerns me with Jacob DeGrom, and this is before we got the news this week, the way he's just throwing so hard in spring training, throwing so hard from the get-go, like you said, the give-it-all-you-got ethos. Is this the backfire? I mean, we all reveled last April when we watched Jacob DeGrom do things that nobody had done in the first several starts. Was there a reason nobody had done it? Was it just that Jacob DeGrom was built better and has more ability than anybody who came before him? Or, you know, is he just coached this way to maximize his talents and then let's hope nothing goes wrong? There's a lot more science today than there was in Mike Marshall's day. Mike Marshall was the outlier in caring about these things. You know, you used to hear about, I didn't pick up a baseball until January. The sort of thing you hear from pitchers, and they certainly weren't weightlifting. But, Jacob DeGrom has landed where he is because of the era he pitches in. So it's hard to pin this on anybody other than this is where we are, and let's hope that this diagnosis is correct, that this is the main thing that's troubling him, and with enough rest, he'll be back. You know, we've heard from pitchers. Brandon McCarthy came to the fore in recent days because he had the same disorder. He said, it's not that big a deal. I came back. I was fine. Matt Harvey actually had this. He wasn't fine, but he had other problems. Michael Wacha came back. This is years before he was on the Mets. So it's at the very least concerning, and you know, an annoyance doesn't cover it because we're without Jacob DeGrom for probably 2 months at minimum. But hopefully this isn't something that continues throughout his career and he can get back to being Jacob DeGrom, albeit by June, a 34-year-old Jacob DeGrom.
Rich, you can pick it up, but Greg used an interesting word, backfire. On Fangraphs, it shows that every year his velocity was going up and up and up and up. Is this the law of diminished returns now? What say you, Rich?
Mike, when it comes to DeGrom, I'll ask this question rhetorically, but if people want to jump in on it, did you really think he was going to have an injury-free season? I thought there was no way he was going to have an injury-free season. My only thought was, when will it happen and how long will he be out? Because as a pitcher, you know, he had issue with his forearm, he had issue with his elbow. That's his tool. His tool is damaged. And, you know, and this is just a new thing on that same tool. So I am not at all surprised this happened. And now we're just in that place where, how long is it going to be? What's he going to be when he comes back? And when is he coming back? But now with that said, you know, everybody says, he throws too hard for a guy of his age, throws hard for anybody, actually. Is that really it? You know, he's throwing 100, 101, maybe 102 on occasion. Other pitchers are throwing 98, 99 on a regular basis. You know, is it that? I'm not sure it is. I'm not sure it's the velocity. Because the velocity he's throwing at is marginally higher than these guys throw hard now. It's marginally higher than a lot of these guys throw. It's not 10 miles an hour higher. Other starting pitchers are up in that same stratosphere. You know, when Scherzer is good, he's 96, 97. He's 37 years old. So my thought is, you know, the human arm only has so many pitches in it. We know that. And whether for DeGrom he's coming to the end of that or not, I don't know. But I just am not ready to say that it's because of the velocity, because it's just not. It's max effort. That's true. But all these guys throw max effort. You know, when Wheeler's throwing 98-99, that's not a mild effort on his part. That's a pretty strong effort. You know, I don't know. That's my take on it. I think it's not a max effort thing and not a velocity thing. It comes down to at what point is his arm going to give in versus someone else's versus someone else's. And maybe we're at that point for Jake. Who knows? I mean, because when the scapula thing, yes, and I read that too, when Brandon McCarthy said he came back just fine, and he may come back just fine. But what might be next? I mean, might it be the elbow? Remember, the elbow is surgically repaired. So I don't know. I wonder about Jake and his future. I think at this point we have to accept what we can get from him and then take it for what it's worth. And I think it's a little bit unrealistic to think that the guy is going to come back and be just fine. I, with all of these issues in the one thing he does, which is a good hitter too, but you know, that doesn't count anymore. The one thing he does with all these issues in his arm, I just find it highly suspect that this is just going to stop. I think this is going to be chronic. Anyway, that's my 2 cents.
This is going to be a problem, Jeff. Stress reaction right scapula. What say you?
Well, best case scenario, as Greg said, would be 2 months. So that puts us in June, which means it'll be, what, 11 months since he's pitched in a major league game. And that's a long time. And as excellent as he is, you wonder if there's going to be any rust, plus there's additional factor of his age. So I am concerned, of course. But you raised a good point earlier about max effort, not Max Scherzer, max effort, because the pitchers are told just throw hard. Everybody's got to throw 100 because it seems like anybody can hit 90. Can hit a ball, fastball that's 90. So you got to throw 98, 99, 100. And if it drops 2, as we saw with Noah Syndergaard, people notice that. Well, there are 10 guys projected to be in the Mets bullpen out of the 28. 10! So there's no reason to tell pitchers stop at to keep some in the tank because there's a minion, as some of us would say, waiting for you, waiting to take over. So if you have 5 innings as the expectation, or in the words of the previous manager, 5 up-downs, then you go all out. And, yes, I think that leads to injury.
Sam, like we said, you know, we've gotten quite the education in all this, all these different types of injuries. What do you say?
Every Mets fan has a degree in medicine or anatomy or whatever you want to call it. But, Mike, there was something else that you said to me when I said that I was rewatching Moneyball, and I currently still am because I've been going through it on basically via transit. So you said to me, I'm going to start calling it Modern Ball. And I believe with everything we've talked about, the conditioning, the working out, et cetera, here is where it all comes down to and how it is a part of Moneyball. And I'm going to bring 2 pitchers into this that both relied on velocity to somewhat, but relied on power and location. And that's David Cohn and Roger Clemens, two people who were involved in the same rotation at some point. And I remember after David Cohn's perfect game, his legs, when he was sitting down with Michael Kay in basically Michael Kay's Kiner's Corner, his legs were humongous. The power always came from the hamstring and the thigh. It came from your legs, the thrust. I'm not saying that they're teaching them to not only, like Noah Syndergaard, work out with his arms and maybe part of the kick and velocity is not only leg power but arm power, but maybe some of the conditioning in terms of power pitchers has gone away from being all about the thrust of the leg forward. We're talking pitching mechanics 101 going back all the way to the beginning of the power pitcher. There may in lie some of the problem in that, I mean, Jacob is a tall, lengthy fellow who doesn't seem to be working out. Maybe he's throwing all year round, but he doesn't seem to be working out like Steven Matz seemed, his upper torso. And I always thought that Steven Matz needed to shed a few pounds of muscle. So maybe that has a lot to do with it, that, like, you looked at some of these power pitchers, and they were huge around the legs. Jacob DeGrom might not be that, and maybe that's where some of the tear of the arm is, because he's putting a lot of that power on his arm and not his legs.
The sad news is that we're starting the season with a compromised 1-2 punch. Scherzer's got his hamstring. Whether that gets better or not or worse, you know, that remains to be seen. We know how things go awry. So let's finish out our pitching anxieties. Are we now in a situation where we have to rely on the best of the rest? And some of the names involved are Tyler Megill. We're back to Jordan Yamamoto like we were last year. David Peterson. I need to know your confidence level in Carlos Carrasco and Tawan Walker. And how well do you think Chris Bassett is going to, you know, adjust to National League? I'll give a little shout out to Ernest Dove over there, a friend of the show. He has confidence in Thomas Zupacki, who will be starting for Syracuse opening day. We may see him in Flushing as well. It's a situation. Not if Scherzer's going to be compromised for a start, two starts. You know, hamstrings are funny. So, Jeff, I will pick it up with you. Where do you feel? How confident are you in the situation?
Moderate. I like Tyler Megill, who apparently might be pitching on Thursday if the game is played. But I am not 100% confident in any of them, and that includes Carrasco. How can you be? He was out for much of the season. When he came back, he had those first inning blues, and he showed some signs, and he has a good pedigree, but I'm not sure if he's going to be what he was. I think he can be. I think Tywan Walker is more the pitcher we saw in the first half of the season when he was an all-star than the second half when he was far from an all-star. And I'm confident in Chris Bassett, but I wish that more was done. And I had been saying that even before the bad news from this week. So moderate confidence.
Oh, my apologies, another dollar in the jar. I was going to switch over to Greg and ask you for your assessment, your feelings, your gut feelings on the present pitching situation.
Well, I would throw in one more name who we saw today, Trevor Williams, who I suppose is a possibility on Thursday if opening day just becomes a goût mélange, as Oscar Madison liked to say. But he's, you know, sort of the taking over the Robert Gsellman swingman role, I figure. It would be great if we had sort of a break glass in case of emergency pitching ace at our disposal. But, you know, this is the depth. I mean, putting aside the 3, 4, and 5 in the rotation of Bassett, Carrasco, and Walker in whatever order they end up falling out, I mean, the idea was that we don't have to lean on David Peterson to develop. We don't have to lean on Tyler Megill to follow up his pretty good first season. We don't have to trust Jordan Yamamoto necessarily. Those guys were going to be 6, 7, 8. Now suddenly it feels like there is no 1 or 1A, and we're scrambling a bit. You know, so something that I have the feeling I'm going to be saying out loud and to myself a lot in the next few days and the first couple of weeks, it's a long season. And that's where pitching depth And this kind of pitching depth, I think, is going to show. And we, you know, again, we may not feel great on Thursday if the opening day starter isn't Jacob DeGrom or Max Scherzer, but I don't think we're short necessarily for the long haul, even though the long haul is only, you know, at this moment, April and maybe May, and we'll have to see. You know, Carrasco has missed a lot of time through his career, you know, coming to the Mets. He was, you know, coming off of problems. So he is a big question mark. I'd like to believe that with a, you know, a winter of training behind him, however strenuous the training is today or not, that he will be stronger. Walker felt like an enigma. I don't know if it was the tacky stuff that was missing in his hands in the second half, but it was a downfall for sure. And Bassett's looked real good in the two starts we've seen. He's got a track record. So, you know, we just got to trust in it right now and also trust in the idea that came up earlier that this is not a sit-still front office and a sit-still organization. And while you can only make so many realistic moves in season, I think they're going to keep an ear open if they're not feeling that their depth is deep enough. But when it comes to the pitching overall, yeah, moderate plus. I'm willing to go there.
That's a little bit more confident than me. Rich, after Tawan Walker and perhaps Bassett, not necessarily in that order. I'm feeling a little queasy. How are you feeling, Rich?
Equally queasy, Mike. I think Bassett, based on who he is, you know, transitioning to the National League, the hitters after just to him too. So I think he will be fine. I think Tawan Walker, my opinion, his second half travails last year were due to, you know, the fact that he hadn't pitched that many innings since 2017, I believe. So I think that you have to give him a pass on that. I think he'll be okay too. So that's two. Now, after that, I am hoping for good things from Carlos Carrasco. Of course, we all root for him based on his medical history. I really hope that he does well. I am not terribly confident that he will. You know, he's in his mid-30s now. He hasn't been good. He wasn't good in 21. He was pretty bad. His ERA was over 6. Now, granted, he only, you know, had two months. But so I think it's a little unrealistic to think that – to have a lot of confidence in him. You have to hope for the best with him is what I'm saying. And then beyond that, you know, I think Trevor Williams, to Greg's point, I think Trevor Williams is a sleeper. I really think that guy knows how to pitch. You know, he doesn't have great stuff, but he knows what he's doing out there, and he's not going to embarrass you. He's going to give you a reasonable start, a reasonable effort. So I'm okay with that. I'm okay with him if you know, in an emergency situation. And then beyond that, you know, David Peterson, from what I've seen, hasn't looked terribly good this spring. So that's a little bit – makes me a little queasy, as you say. I really would like to see the Mets get an arm from outside the organization. I don't want to see them go into, you know, and go into the season with a lot of question marks at the beginning and dropping these games. I would hope that they can acquire an arm before Thursday. In my heart, I believe that's what they're trying to do. If you look at the deal they made today, you know, maybe that's a precursor. The Padres made a deal today, you know, bringing in Minaya. So maybe, maybe they're in a position where they might be looking to deal an arm and looking for you know, some of the position players the Mets have. Anyway, I'd like to see some help from outside the organization. I am queasy. Like I said, I'm okay with Bassett and Walker, but beyond that, I have the heebie-jeebies, so I wouldn't mind seeing an arm come in from outside the organization.
So, Sam, close out this segment. How are you feeling? How confident are you?
Well, for one thing, it doesn't seem like the Mets have had good luck with people with last names Carrasco. Now we have DJ and Carlos. And Carlos was, before coming to the Mets, the much better Carrasco than Mr. DJ. It seems just as Metsian as it can get in terms of not getting the best out of a pitcher that is now in the later stages. I think that I'm still rather confident in terms of somebody that we haven't even heard of yet. And maybe Zelensky is that person, quote unquote, haven't heard of, that all of this ends up being their chance to shine. And that's where I lean, is that somehow, some way, especially in this day and age, when we talk about the starting pitcher has a more diminished role now because the relievers just take over as soon as the sun is setting or the clock is ticking, however you want to look at it. So I have a feeling they're going to be able to piece this together one way or another, whether it's because some starting pitcher that we haven't even heard of gets a chance to shine. Maybe Tyler McGill takes another step. Even just looking at him in his interview where, like, I'll be ready to go, you can tell that he has 1 year of big league baseball under his belt. Like we were saying about Taijuan Walker, he may be ready to go a full year now that he's gotten a chance to. He did kind of even out by the end of that second half. So let's roll, baby. Let's go.
Where's Sid Finch when you need him? You're listening to the Metsian Podcast this evening, and our featured guests are the proprietors, the co-podcasters of National League Town. Mr. Jeff Heisen, please tell us more about what you're doing and where we can find it and where we can find you in social media and anything else you care to put out there for the general public.
Well, thank you for asking. I'm a attorney, comedian, transplanted New Yorker living in the Washington, D.C. area, but of most paramount interest here, I was in New York and still am a loyal Mets fan. And just like being a New Yorker, that doesn't change no matter where you go. So I'm proudly wear my Mets hat, wear the Mets colors in the Washington, D.C. area. I was walking on the streets of Bethesda a month ago, and a car stopped, and the woman yelled out, "Let's go Mets!" And I yelled, "Let's go Mets!" And it was a special moment. And I'm scheduled to be there on Friday, sitting on, of course, the third base side, which is the Mets side, rooting on the Mets, weather permitting. But National League Town is a co-venture with Greg Prince, who you know from Faith and Fear and Flushing, the book, which Greg is too modest to say was named one of the 100 best baseball books of all time by Esquire magazine. And, of course, Faith and Fear website, blog. But Greg and I collaborated on a Mets podcast, which doesn't have the word Mets in it, in the title, which may not have been the best strategy because it makes it that much harder to find. But we're about Mets fandom, as we say, Mets history and Mets life. There are plenty of excellent podcasts, including this one, which will discuss the merits of Alex Claudio versus Chasen Shreve and whether the Mets have enough catching depth in the organization, things like that. And we'll get to that. But with Greg, we're discussing more than that. We're about getting that water bottle through security at Citi Field. And what's it like being a Mets fan out of the Washington, D.C. area? And Greg will elaborate more on that.
Thank you very kindly, Jeff, again, for your presence on this evening's show. Mr. Prince, tell us more about what you do, where we can find it.
Well, you can find National League Town on all popular podcast platforms and presumably some unpopular podcast platforms. I don't know if you guys know the name Willie Yarborough. Willie Yarborough is the man who drove the Madden Cruiser for a bunch of years and got it where it was going, mapped out the routes, was responsible for making sure John Madden showed up from, you know, Texas Stadium to Candlestick Park or wherever he was going. I bring up Willie Yarborough because Jeff is sort of the Willie Yarborough of our podcast, and I get the pleasure of walking up and down the aisle, waving my arms like John Madden and just saying whatever comes off the top of my head and treating it as insightful. But Jeff has gotten this podcast going, and I really appreciate that. You know, like he said, we're a couple of Mets fans, and we've spent so many years via phone, via email, and occasionally via sitting next to each other at Citi Field or Nationals Park or Citizens Bank, going back and forth about being Mets fans. Finally, Jeff had the good idea of saying, why don't we share this with the world, or at least you know, a handful of other people who might listen in. So that's what we've been doing since, gosh, I guess February. Do we go back that far? I'm not sure. Maybe January. But the rest of the time, from a baseball perspective, you can indeed find me and my other partner in baseball life, Jason Fry, doing Faith and Fear in Flushing, faithandfearinflushing.com, entering its 18th, I was going to say record-breaking. I have no idea what that record would be, though. Our 18th season of covering the Mets on a game-by-game basis, plus whatever we've been doing to fill up the hours of, as Rogers Hornsby said, staring out the window and waiting for baseball. So, you know, this is always a good time of year because we know that the season is at hand. We know that we're all getting our biorhythms together again. You know, we talk about being Mets fans. We talk about it on this show. We talk about it on our show. We'll write about it on my blog. But now it's time for action, to actually be Mets fans and have something new to talk about and have something to react to and something to look forward to, no matter how shallow or deep the pitching pool is and the rest of the lineup. So, again, it's always a pleasure to join you guys and your podcast that has Mets in the title. And I hope folks who are listening to this will try us out too.
That's another dollar in the jar. Sam, I'll throw it to you if you have any questions.
Yeah, I just wanted to say to both Greg and Jeff, you know, I've known Greg a long time, and also, you know, what brought me to the Mets is the National League, and especially as we get farther and farther from the distinction of these two leagues, I just have to say that I think it's the perfect podcast to represent the Mets and what they are, because, and especially, Jeff, what you said about your interaction in Maryland. Nobody yells out a car about a Yankee hat because anybody could be wearing a Yankee hat. There could possibly be somebody wearing a Yankee hat who is not a diehard. But if you're wearing that orange and blue Mets cap, you know that's a fan, and they always say something back to you. So let's go Mets, and thank you for National League Town.
Well, thank
Rich,
you.
Anything?
Very nice.
Thank you, Sam.
Rich? All right,
hey,
gentlemen.
Rich. Oh, we lost Rich.
Oh, did we? We'll get him back.
Yeah, give me a second.
All right, gentlemen.
Muted.
Very quickly, the Mets made a trade with the Yankees. We traded Miguel Castro, right-handed relief pitcher, to the Yankees for Jolly Rodriguez, a left-handed relief pitcher. It's clear that the Mets need lefties. We need a lot of lefties. We're bereft of lefties. So I get it, but this trade didn't go over well on Mets Twitter. So very quickly, reliever for reliever, how do you guys, or how did you digest this trade? Sam, I'll start with you.
I mean, I haven't taken a look completely at the numbers, but I guess, yeah, it was getting a lot of different heat. I think, yeah, righty for lefty, and the reliever situation is always in flux. So we had talked about needing more lefties within the system. I mean, this is this is still something, as much as we're now falling into modern ball, Mike, this is still something you got to be concerned about, righty-lefty. So I'm going to have to analyze it more before I throw a fit on Twitter.
And what Sam is talking about, I broke baseball up this way. There's baseball, two words. There's baseball the way we once knew it, and now there's modern baseball, the third era. So, Jeff, this trade, we obviously need left-handers. Anybody with a heartbeat and can throw left-handed, they have value. But it comes at the expense of Miguel Castro. I just wish we could have added to him as opposed to having to trade him. Couldn't we have done anything else?
Well, they had a good lefty reliever last season, and they let him go to do Los Angeles and the Angels. And, of course, that's Aaron Loop. And apparently they felt that the price the Angels were paying him was not worth it for a lefty reliever. Well, this is what happens. They didn't make that investment in Loop, and now they're scrambling. So, and then they didn't sign Andrew Chafin, who went elsewhere. And that was the big name, if a left-handed reliever can have a big name that's not a closer. And the Mets didn't sign him either. So they end up with Claudio, who's a minor league free agent. They pick up Jason Shreve, who's apparently done very well. But if those guys were the answer, would they have made this trade? So I think they had the guys, and they let them get away. And that's disturbing to me.
What say you, Greg?
I'm going to miss Miguel Castro, to be honest. I don't know enough about Rodriguez to speak authoritatively, so I won't pretend to know anything about him other than I saw his ERA that may or may not be indicative of what he can do. And, yes, he's a lefty, and I thought the two guys who were competing for that position were having a pretty good spring. But like Jeff said, they must not have felt that confidence. Castro had really electric stuff that, when he controlled it, was really effective, and I was beginning to get some confidence in looking forward to Miguel Castro pitching whatever inning he would have been pitching, because as Sam pointed out, as much as we talk about starting pitching, that unless you're in DeGrom Scherzer country, you're looking at getting the bullpen up in the fourth inning a lot of nights, almost by design, certainly by the fifth inning. So, Castro had his rough patches when he came over in 2020 and last year, but I thought he rebounded nicely as the season went by. But you've got a lot of right-handed relievers both on the roster and in the system, so I guess you can spare one. If Jolie Rodriguez is the answer, then we've made a great deal. If he's not, then it's a shame to let Castro go, and obviously all of the positive vibes I was collecting on his behalf go out the window because of who he was traded to. But, good luck anyway, Miguel.
Do we have Rich back, Sam?
I am back.
We do.
All right.
I apologize, Rich. Mike. I went to unmute my AirPods, and I accidentally hit the hang-up button, so I apologize.
That's quite okay. Whatever you want to say about that little transaction. But also kick us off on the transaction that wasn't. Obviously, Dom Smith was on the table in conversations with the Padres. Mets would have received Chris Paddock, Camilo Pagan, and Eric Hosmer. Do you think that would have been worthwhile? I understand the Mets trying to make a transaction to fortify their pitching. Do you think Dom is still on the trading block? I will say that he spoke his mind, Dom Smith, that is, and he doesn't want to be stuck in a platoon situation. So, where do we go from here?
Well, starting with Jolie Rodriguez, I think it's interesting that this might be the first player in Mets history whose first name is an adverb, right? I couldn't help that. But anyway, in looking at Jolie Rodriguez, so what did the Mets get? Well, yeah, you have both guys who are in their last year of team control. They both be free agents after the season. And it makes some sense to go righty for lefty. Now, what's been said before is obviously very accurate. Castro has lights out stuff when he can command it. That's the question. Who did we get? Well, Mets got a guy who has a career whip over four years of 1.54. So that's not really all that good. You know, when you're coming in a relief situation, especially in the middle of an inning, you don't really want guys who give up walks and hits. Now, that's kind of obvious, right? So in terms of his walks per nine innings, four walks per nine innings over his career on average. So that's not really good either. That shows you he does have some control issues. And his strikeout per nine is 8.4, which is decent but not great. So it seems like the Mets went after this guy, you know, not so much because he's lights out, but because, as we've said, he throws with his left hand, which the Mets do need. You know, they need somebody that, you know, you can't really rely on Shreve and Claudio. And maybe Peterson will be in the bullpen, who knows. But it seems like they needed a lefty. They got a lefty that was available. They basically traded one guy who could be lights out when on for somebody who seems to be pretty pedestrian. You know, his career ERA is 4.6, which I know is not much of a statistic when you're looking at a relief pitcher. He has a career WAR of less than one. It's like a negative 0.06. So I know WAR is also a little bit less useful when looking at a relief pitcher. So it's not like we got Josh Hader here, fellas. Okay, anyway, so then moving on to Dom. That deal with the Padres, you know, I just want to say this. I know Mets fans are like, oh, my God, you can't do that. And look, I don't want Hosmer on this team. He clearly would have been flipped. You know, you don't trade somebody because you don't need a backup first baseman, or at least not that backup first baseman, for another one who would be – you'd be paying a lot of money, even if the Padres took a lot of the contract. So so really what you'd be trading for was Paddock. You know, they need an arm in the rotation. Paddock, since 19, has not been good. High upside, sure, throws hard, has that swagger to him. Was that worth it, Pagan? Useful bullpen piece? Here's my take on that. I would have been okay with that trade. I would, because Dom Smith, I love Dom Smith. I do, okay? But he doesn't fit here, folks. If they made the decision to go Alonso's the franchise first baseman at this point, Dom doesn't fit here. It's not fair to him. You know, he's not a backup. You don't want to make this poor young man a backup. Let this guy go somewhere and play. It's not fair to, because we like him, to tell him to rot on the bench. He is not a left fielder, so let's just get that off the table. Dom is the guy you put in left field in the 25th inning. That's what he is. His career, his outs above average last year in left field was minus 10. Now, you could argue that in a larger sample, it could have gotten better, and that's true. In a larger sample, it could have gotten worse. So he's not a good left fielder. He's well below his outs above average, is well in the negative numbers throughout his career in the outfield. You have to move him. I'm sorry. I like him too. You have to move him. He doesn't fit. And you move him for something you need, and the Mets would have gotten a starting pitcher, albeit a flawed one. So here, to answer your question, Mike, not the greatest trade in the world. I would have jumped up and down being happy about it, because Paddock, who knows what he is? And that's really who you were trading for. And maybe you could have flipped Hosmer for something you need as well. But I do think Dom is definitely on the table. I think J.D. Davis is definitely on the table. Billy Epler, he's smart enough to know that keeping these guys around who don't fit just doesn't make sense, especially when you have needs. So I do think you're going to – I would not be surprised if Dom were dealt this week before opening day. Maybe back to the Padres again. They picked up Sean Manaea. Maybe they're willing to deal a pitcher now. I've heard Snell's name thrown out there. I'd love to have him. Of course, it would cost a lot more than Dom, but, you know, we'll see what might happen there. But I do think you'll see Dom moved, and I think it's for the best for him and for the Mets. I'd love to see J.D. Davis, who has less of a role than Dom does. Love to see him shipped out too. Nothing against the guy. He just doesn't fit. So that's what I think. I think with the Mets being committed to a deep October run this year and having some misfit parts, I do think Billy Epler, and if they have to take some bad money to do it, I think that's the benefit of having Steve Cohen. But I do think Epler will make those moves. I think he's well aware of the fact that there are guys who just don't fit here. You might be muted,
Rich,
Mike.
I think you're absolutely... Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Rich. Before I go on, remember I told you all to get
paper and pencil, I'm going to ask you for your ideal opening game lineup. Just keep that in mind. That's to end the show. However, Jeff, I'm in lockstep with what Rich says. My fear is Dom Smith will go somewhere, and he will turn into the next Bill Madlock from the left side. That's what I envision. But I will say this, and let's just open up to all positions and all players now. It's an open forum. Abbott and Costello were not prepared for the designated hitter. The Mets are in a similar situation. Who's on first? What's on second? I don't know who's on third, which just brought up Brady Davis and whatnot. You know, so what kind of name are we going to come up with the DH? You figure it out, you know, with the question mark. So I don't know. Jeff, pick it up. How did you feel about that potential trade? Does he fit? And how do you see this, the diamond and the outfield shaping out? Who do you want to see out there?
Well, I was somewhat okay with it. I hate losing Dom, but he's superfluous. And you're right, he's not going to play the outfield well. And Pete's a better first baseman than he is a DH. I think his head gets all wrapped up in every at-bat. And if he's playing first base, he's not thinking about his last strikeout for 20 minutes while he's on the bench. I think he wants his glove to be gold, and I think he has improved as a first baseman. So where's Dom going to play? Plus, the last 2 days or the last two games have been the Cano audition. He played first base. He had four hits today. Didn't embarrass himself at first base. So he's a lefty. Dom's a lefty. So if you're going to move somebody, unfortunately, it's going to be Dom. And if you're afraid to make a trade because someone's going to turn into Bill Madlock, which is a natural feeling, maybe not Bill Madlock, but maybe it's a natural feeling to be concerned that they're going to blow up elsewhere, and you're never going to make a trade. What I'd rather see, though, is another call to Oakland, since Oakland's probably on speed dial, if they still have speed dial, it's Citi Field, and it's checking on Frankie Montas. Since Oakland's trading a lot of players, they traded Sean Manea today. They traded Bassett to the Mets. Maybe they'll trade their opening day starter in Montas, who's better than Bassett. And maybe it'll take Dom plus Peterson or Dom plus McGill or Dom plus Sapuki. But I would do it, and I would do it before the end of this show.
I can't say I disagree. Sam, pick it up.
Rich may have finally convinced me, as much as Dom is, it's just been something that I've latched onto since he got drafted. You're right, and he does fit with the Padres, especially if you move Eric Hosmer. I watched a video about how Eric Hosmer doesn't seem to fit with the Padres from a chemistry standpoint. So, yes, we would flip him, but, you know, like, yeah, Rich, you really did one on me there. As much as I love Dom, I have a Smith 22 T-shirt, blue and orange T-shirt that I bought at the same time, pairing it with a Robin Ventura black T-shirt. As much as that just goes way back for me, he does fit with the Padres. It does now somewhat make sense with the idea of flipping Eric Hosmer. And if you don't, maybe he does fit better with the chemistry of this team as an aging first baseman. Yeah, and that's just everything we've just heard. Dom does – I've been saying that he still has the most value because of his flexibility, and you can get him in the lineup on a daily basis anywhere, really, technically, in terms of between the two places with the DH now involved. However, he could be an all-star caliber first baseman. So do you want him to win a championship with the New York Mets, or do you want him to fulfill his destiny elsewhere, one way or another? It's a tough one for me, but Rich may have finally convinced me, especially given the Mets' needs.
Greg, why does Bill Madlock pop into my head when we talk Dom Smith? I know one was righty and lefty, but I foresee that. Why?
That's a lofty aspiration for Dom Smith and a pretty nice comparison, and he should be flattered if he's if he's indeed listening tonight. You know, Dom Smith is one of those players, I think, when we look at him as Mets fans, we see every base hit he's ever gotten and forget all the base hits he hasn't gotten. But, you know, we're talking about a guy who has only played the equivalent of one full season within a season, and that was last year, and it wasn't much of a year. He was wonderful in 2020, and before that, he was still finding his footing right up until that, you know, magical last at bat of the 2019 season, which is kind of his signature swing in a Mets uniform. You know, I felt disappointed in myself for not feeling more crushed when it looked like he was going to go away. But as has been mentioned here, he is kind of like J.D. Davis, that spare part. You're putting together a table or a chest of drawers or something you got at IKEA, and you've got that stuff that's laying there on the carpet when you're done. And at the moment, that's Dom Smith and J.D. Davis, which is not to say they can't contribute on some days, but if you have moves still to make, you're not going to hold back. You know, Paddock has been intriguing for 3 years. He hasn't been productive, but he was the kind of pitcher who, you know, I could see where an organization would look at him and say, hey, we can I don't want to say fix him because that brings up all the Rick Peterson in 10 minutes jokes, but, you know, we can get him right and we can get the most out of him and won't San Diego feel badly that they gave up on him. So, you know, I agree there are still moves to be made here. And no, I'm not sure that with Cano around, I'm not sure that a Dom Smith, J.D. Davis platoon at, if you'll excuse the expression, designated hitter, is something that would come to pass. I'm not sure if it's, you know, again, well, I can't say I'm not sure. I know from what I'm reading, it's not what Dom Smith wants out of his life. And if he is worthwhile to somebody, I guess, yeah, you continue to dangle him. But one thing I will take issue with what Rich said about Dom Smith being a 25th inning left fielder, I think if you can get to a past a 10th inning with the crazy ghost runner rule, I think you could live with Dom Smith in the in left field by the 18th inning. So, you know, that's my confidence in his defense. But, you know, I hope that when we turn around in a couple of months and Dom Smith's getting one big hit after another in some context that we weren't seeing, we can get together again and say, boy, aren't the best trades the ones you don't make? And isn't it great that Dom Smith turned into Bill Madlock for us and not for somebody else?
Greg, I'm going to stay with you real quick, and this is a shout-out to Crane Pool, at Crane Pool on Twitter, because it was his tweet, and I agree with him 100%. This is about the catcher. Who do you want to see, Thomas Nito or James McCann? I agree with Crainpool when he said he wants to see Nito as the starting catcher. And I think as a starting catcher, what are we talking about? 65-35% of the playing time? It might even be closer than that. I don't know. But who do you prefer? Greg, I'll start with you.
Well, I think McCann's contract prefers it be McCann. But this particular front office hopefully won't be guided by that and insist. I mean, I think the difference in McCann and Nito is that we know what McCann's upside may not be the right word. We know what McCann has accomplished. Question is, can he accomplish it again? Because he only did it basically for 1 year and it was a couple of years ago. Is Nito getting any better? He seems to be having a good spring. He hasn't really shown anything that gets you excited about him on a day-to-day basis offensively, but defensively, the pitchers who pitched to him seem to trust him. McCann was kind of hot and cold last year in that regard. You know,
I hate to cherry pick anecdotally here, but the Baltimore Orioles had a lot of success using two starting catchers way back when it was Etchebarren and Hendricks. So that those names just popped into my head thinking about it. That's why I can kind of see these two guys, if not in a strict platoon, then sharing time a lot more than the concept of starting catcher would allow us to think. Let's also throw in, you know, a little bit of an X factor here, which is James McCann. Not that them necessarily need him all that often because we got Alonso, still have Smith, and yeah, Cano has been trying out there. McCann played a decent first base last year, so if you want to get his bat in there on a given night, plus whatever the hell goes on with the DH. That's a long way of saying I don't really have a horse in this race, but I would think that McCann is going to be given every opportunity to keep the job, and Nito can become the dumb Smith of the backstop set and wonder, am I just going to age while I'm sitting here on the bench?
Jeff, do you have a preference?
Yes, that Francisco Alvarez ages 1 year and is ready soon. But short of that, yes, as Greg said, it's going to be McCann. He was signed to be the number one catcher. And last year aside, he does have good numbers, not JT Realmuto numbers. I still haven't gotten over that yet, but still has good numbers. And maybe he needed a year to acclimate himself to the National League, to New York, to the Mets pitchers, to the Mets way of doing things. And so maybe he'll settle in. He and his wife and the twins will settle in. Having said that, I've gone from being anti-Nito to pro-Nito. So I'm okay with him, but I think we're going to see McCann.
Who are you putting behind the plate, Sam?
It could be a 3-4 combination, basically. 3 days a week, 4 days a week, interchangeably per week. And I'd be fine with that, too. I'll go with what Greg said, a platoon. And, you know, bringing it also full circle, considering Buck has once managed the Baltimore Orioles. So there you go. That's my answer.
And Rich?
Well, to be diplomatic, I think you split the time. McCann did not distinguish himself last year. You know, 10 home runs, 232 batting average, an OPS of 643. Those are not numbers that say, boy, this guy should be the starter, no question. Nito also in a backup role. You know, let's remember the guy did win a batting title in Double-A. I think the guy can hit. He had a great day today. Let's do a Gil Hodges here and use a platoon to try to get the most out of both people. I don't think either should be getting 65% of the time. I'd look at pretty close to 50-50. You know, catchers are – they take a beating back there. Let's try to give them both time. Let's use them both and try to keep both healthy and go with that.
And it's going to be a compressed schedule, as we know, so well said. Jeff, I'm glad you brought up Francisco Alvarez. Very quickly, I just want to say, if I had my way, he'd be banned from Flushing this season. I don't want to see him anywhere near Flushing this season. I want him serving a full year at Binghamton. He can, you know, be promoted to AAA late in the season, but as far as I'm concerned, he's banned from Flushing by the Bay. That's not even up for debate. Not going to throw that around the room. That's my prerogative. But I will throw away your way, gentlemen, as I shared an email with everybody before the show. And what I'm doing is I'm taking away Pete Alonso and I'm taking away Francisco Lindor. And I'm asking each of you who most important positional players on this roster as presently constituted. And then you tell me how confident you are in that core five to get us to a division title. So I will start with you, Sam.
Starlin Marte has to start off that list. I think he is crucial to the success of this team combined with the two players you mentioned. And after that, I will have to say Brandon Nimmo. You mentioned lineup. I wouldn't mind Marte leading off and then Nimmo 9, or maybe even, well, no, we're not putting Starlin Marte in the 9th, so am I about to do the vice versa thing there? And then I would say, in terms of importance,
yeah,
Pinoe is rather important here. And the way he goes about his season, because he's going to, I think if we're talking about a platoon, and especially the DH now, he could very well be platooning with Jeff McNeil at second base, and Canoe specifically getting in the lineup somehow, some way between second base and DH. Probably more DH than anything, you know, considering he's climbing to 40. So that I would have to say split him with Eduardo Escobar as the two most important rounding out the five. I discussed it last week about Eduardo Escobar's numbers. He could be the sleeper of this team. You know, I haven't done enough of a 40 to even 28 roster research as we close into opening day, Mike, but that's my initial thoughts as I look at today's lineup in front of me.
I hear you. So, Jeff, I took away Alonso and I took away Lindor. Who are the most three important positional players on the Mets?
Well, I'll start with E squared and Eduardo Escobar. He's starting at third base, but when they signed him, I thought he was going to play second base because they would get Chris Bryant. Well, they didn't get Chris Bryant for third base, so Escobar is the third baseman. He's projected at Fangraphs to have 26 home runs, and he needs to do that. That's important. He seems like a good guy. He's an important piece of this puzzle, especially somebody who most Met fans didn't know anything about when they signed him. From there, I'll go to a squirrel, because is McNeil going to be last year's McNeil, or is it going to be the previous year's McNeil? We know that he's going to be yelling every time he makes an out, but hopefully he'll make fewer outs. He hit his bad luck with that show last season, and I think he can come back, but that's important because he's the second baseman. He's the starting second baseman, and he's my number two. And the third one is big league foodie Mark Canha, because when they signed him, I said, oh, good, he'll be an excellent fourth outfielder. No, he's an excellent starting outfielder, hopefully. I'm not super impressed with his batting skills, but I think he can be a good player. Can he make the switch from the American League to the National League and play 140 games every day and shine? I think he's critical to the Mets.
Interesting list. Very interesting. Rich, what say you?
Well, I think you've got to go with Nimmo and Marte, clearly, as two of the three, because if you're saying the givens, so to speak, are Lindor and Alonso, well, who has to get on base to make their at-bats most productive? That would be Marte and Nimmo. So I think those guys would be critical. The top of the lineup is always critical. So I have to go with Nimmo and Marte. And then I'm torn between Escobar and McNeil. I have to go with Escobar here as my third, only because I think the top of his game is higher than the top of McNeil's game. I mean, Escobar, you got a switch hitter, you got a guy with power, you know, a guy who can get on base too, and a nice player. And so because of the ceiling, his ceiling, in my opinion, being higher than that of Jeff McNeil, I'm going to go with Escobar.
Wow. I love this question. Greg, your turn.
Definitely Marte. I think he's right there with Alonso and Lindor. He just brings another dimension, a five-tool dimension that this team has not really had. I think the fact that he's split over to right field with a little muss or fuss on Nimmo, who would be my other guy of the triumvirate, to use your word,
you know, Nimmo is now going to play center field, which he worked real hard to make himself into a really good center fielder. And, you know, that's two-thirds of the outfield right there that I have a lot of confidence in. Plus, I believe this is Nimmo's walk year. So he's going to be motivated to make himself very marketable, I would imagine. And if he stays healthy, I would look for a big year at the top of the lineup. Just because all the other names have been mentioned and because we gave them their own little segment, let me say Jay Moss, Nick Nito is important. The catcher, whoever it is, just to revisit that very quickly, it can't be a black hole. Even though it's a pretty good lineup all around, it felt like a black hole last year. And I would like to believe that, you know, for all the wear and tear those guys are going to have, that they will combine to hit a little. So I think, you know, everybody else has been spoken for. And I think, you know, everybody else is going to contribute in one way or another. But I would like to see this catching platoon, or, you know, whatever percentage it winds up being, you know, be a legitimate offensive contributor. Again, we don't have to have Gary Carter at the top of his game, or Mike Piazza, but, you know, give me Jerry Grody like production from the second half of his career, and, you know, give me the defense that these guys are capable of. And, you know, I think that's the difference between an okay club and a very good club at the end of the day.
Very well said, gentlemen. And Greg, everyone has been spoken for, as you say. So let's put them in order. Gentlemen, I ask you to form a lineup, your desired, your preferred lineup for the season opener. If you're ready, I will start with you, sir.
I'm ready. And I'm starting with Brandon Nimmo batting ninth. Because ninth, we have to get used to that. Because I think Sterling Marte, is the choice for batting leadoff. He stole, let me just double check this, 47 bases last year. So you're getting a center fielder who stole 47 bases, and you're starting him in right field batting second. I'm mystified by this. I know that Marte had some oblique tightness, but he looked fine today. He stole third base in a spring training game, so he looked fine. I would start with him and then go to McNeil. So McNeil second before Lindor, and then one of the two or both get on, and then you have Lindor, Alonso, and Escobar, and now you're cooking. And then from there, the DH spot, then followed by Canna, McCann, and then Nimmo. I think that's the winning lineup, at least from my perspective.
Very interesting. Rich?
I hear what Jeff was saying about having, like, I think somebody once called the two leadoff hitters when you have the two speed guys, 9-1, and I get that. However, I'm going to lean on more traditional thinking and say that Nimmo, and his extremely high on-base percentage, he would be the guy to lead it off. And so I'm going to go with him, you know, and his propensity to walk and his 400 OBP that he can do. Go with him first and go with Marte second. Both of those guys can run. Obviously, Marte is a much more accomplished base stealer, but both of those guys have excellent speed. So go with those two up top, Nimmo, Marte, and then go with Lindor third, your best hitter, like Keith always says, typically best third. So let's do that, Lindor third. Pete, obviously, fourth. I like Escobar fifth. I think get that power right behind Pete to give him some protection. I really like that idea. I do agree that the DH spot should be sixth, but let's say it's Cano, because you're seeing more righties than lefties on the mound for the opposing team, so let's say it's Cano. And then rounding out the lineup, I would go McNeil, Canna, and then the catcher. That's how I would do it.
Wow. Sam, what do you say?
I have to echo the idea of Marte ninth, Nimmo. I'm sorry, Marte first, Nimmo ninth, and then you would go Lindor, Alonso. I would go Escobar next, McNeil wherever he can be good, and then whoever's DHing, then than McCann or Nida.
I love this. These are good problems to have. What say you, Greg?
I don't think I can stand to wait three innings or, you know, how, you know, the end of the first inning, because we're going to be batting around like crazy. But I don't think I can stand to wait that long to see Brandon Nimmo, although I totally understand the 9-1 business, as much as I don't want to understand it because I fucking hate the DH, as I think I've mentioned once or twice in my life. So I'm going to keep Nimmo and his marvelous on-base percentage at the top of the lineup and treat Marte as the second leadoff hitter there who's got some power, and it's always been sort of the goal in life to have a really good hitter, not just a guy who can handle the bat batting second. Lindor, who I think is primed for a really good comeback here. Alonso, because I can't stand the idea of a home run derby champion batting anywhere but cleanup. Escobar, who I also have a lot of faith in, batting fifth. Might want to see J.D. Davis on opening day if we're talking Texas, you know, specifically opening day, because I believe he's had some success against Patrick Corbin, but whoever the DH is, you wouldn't figure it unless you're doing something clever with a speed guy, having the DH bat any lower than that. And after that, I think I'd like McNeil. Again, I haven't done all the lefty-righty things in my head, but I don't want to drop McNeil necessarily to eighth or ninth because he just seems like the type who would get down on himself, so maybe I put him seventh. Kanna can probably deal with batting eighth. And our marvelous platoon catcher, whoever he may be, come Thursday and the days after, probably batting ninth. But I also get the feeling between Buck Showalter being who he is, between this front office being composed as it is, we shouldn't get too used to the idea of this is our lineup, because I think everything that's been thrown out there and things that we haven't even thought of are going to happen where lineups are concerned. Even if they get off to a great start, it doesn't seem like the kind of team where they're just going to stand pat and say, well, we've got our lineup, because that's just not how it works anymore. And I think, you know, that is the new ideal in baseball. It may be not ideal to our way of thinking necessarily. So, you know, this is a fun exercise, and I'm glad I sharpened my pencil and got my school supplies as Mike asked me to. But I think we, you know, again, I believe this is something we said on National League Town last week, quoting Bob Murphy, there's a reason they put erasers on pencils, except for the pencils you get when you buy a scorecard, because we're probably going to be erasing these lineups and using lots of paper to keep up with Buck and Epler and the analytics department and everything they think of to maximize this crew they put together.
My only confusion, batting first to second, would be Nimmo and Marte. Either one, I'm okay. Marte first, Nimmo second, Nimmo first, Marte second. I love Escobar in the box.
And may I just say that, Mike, I forgot anybody who would be in left field in my lineup. I'm pretty sure my lineup was only eight, but I guess that also means something else needs to give when it comes to maybe signing another outfielder.
Well, I don't know, because if you noticed when we put out all our lineups, there's a certain name that didn't come up too frequently, and that was Dom Smith. As Rich says,
who we all love.
Fit. What are we going to do? You know, what are we going to do? So, you know, that's a matter for another show. You're listening to the Metsian Podcast, and our guests this evening have been Greg Prince, Jeff Heisen of the National League Town Podcast. Gentlemen, thank you so very much for your time and wonderful, wonderful, entertaining conversation and Metsian banter. Greg, please, on behalf of your partners, tell us again what you guys are doing together, and please tell us what you're doing also with your other partner over at Faith and Fear.
Sure. National League Town Podcast devoted to Mets fandom, Mets history, Mets life. I'll throw in Mets culture just the joy of being a Mets fan and the attendant anxiety that goes with it. And, you know, that's something we post weekly for all ears to hear. And Jason Fry and I continuing on with Faith and Fear in Flushing, the blog for Mets fans who like to read. And we will be ready for opening day like all Mets fans and hopefully unfurling 162 happy recaps or even miserable recaps, but written entertainingly, we hope, as they come to pass. So thank you very much for having us on the show tonight.
Thanks.
All right, gentlemen. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeff. Unless anybody has any other outstanding matters, questions, comments, or rude remarks, we will move on to our final word. Going once, going twice, let's go Mets. This is the way we close out the show. It's just a final word, whatever's on your mind, however you choose to bid farewell to our audience and leave an impression in their mind. I'll start with Rich. Rich, what is your final word, sir?
Anticipation. Can't wait for Thursday. Can't wait to see how this whole thing's going to play out, you know, with the new Mets under Buck Showalter and navigating the injuries on the pitching staff and what kind of trades might be made before Thursday. So eager anticipation. That's two words, but work with me.
Greg, I will go to you for your final word, sir.
Final word, plural, final words. Gil Hodges bobblehead day, July 24th, when the real Gil
Yay!
Hodges is inducted into the Hall of Fame. The Mets will be giving to the first 25,000. You know, I would have excused them if they had said the first 14,000, but it would have been nice if they had one for everybody. But a chance to celebrate Gil Hodges twice at Citi Field this year. I know the family will be there for the second game of the season, throwing out the first pitch, having some kind of ceremony, and then an equally joyous event in July. And I just want to, you know, tip the cap one more time, not just to the legacy of Gil Hodges, but to the fact that the Mets, through all their ownerships, going back to Joan Payson, and yes, through a Doubleday, through Will Pond, and right up to Steve Cohn, have always treated Gil Hodges as the Hall of Famer he's always been. And it's so wonderful that now we get to dovetail that with this celebration in Cooperstown of Gil Hodges as a Hall of Famer. So when I saw that they were giving out a bobblehead later this season, my first thought, of course, as it always is as a Met fan, like, they haven't already done that. And of course I knew they hadn't, and to say bravo. So just very excited that this on the 50th anniversary of his passing that we just passed yesterday is going to be a year to celebrate Gil Hodges multiple times. So here's to number 14 one more time.
Hear, hear. Well said. Well said, and thank you. Jeff Eisen, the co-host of National League Town Podcast, what is your final word, sir?
Well, first, this has been a treat. Thank you very much. It's my final word is hope. Optimism, hope, because if we're not going to be optimistic now, even Met fans' level of optimism, when else are we going to be optimistic? So let's think positive thoughts, and as always, let's go Mets.
I will merely say optimism. I'm optimistic. I like the short-term plan. I like the long-term plan. So I'm just looking to have fun this summer. Sam, I will throw it to you. Bring us home, wrap this baby up, and as we say, let's go Mets. So bring us home, Sam, please.
I'm going to go with the word cliche because my three words are truly hope springs eternal. I am not thankful that I have to choose between getting the bobblehead and going to the ceremonies. But I will accept that I will have to finagle a Gil Hodges bobblehead from people I know who will be going to the game, because I think I'm leaning on going up to Cooperstown the day that Gil Hodges gets into the Hall of Fame. I was desperately crying that he would get in the night and day that he got eventually elected. And when he finally did get elected, it was tears of elation, tears of gratefulness, tears of relief is the word I was looking for. And it even brings tears to my eyes now to think, especially in the light of the anniversary, the 50th anniversary that we just went through, that we're still missing Gil Hodges and also celebrating him still. And I'm so thankful as I tear up on the end of this Metzian podcast. Why'd you leave it for me, Mike?
That's
Gil
wonderful.
Hodges is getting
baseball
into the Hall of Fame.
And that's because baseball comes from the heart. What a perfect way to end this episode. Happy baseball, everyone. Enjoy the 2022 season. Let's go, Mets. And be well, be kind, and be there at Citi Field. Good night, everyone. Thank you all.
Let's go, Mets, baby.
Good night, everyone.
Good night. Good night.